Welcome back to the Brew University Book Club Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Weaver, and with me, as always, are book club adventurers taking us through chapter-by-chapter breakdown of Entree Leadership, our Season 1 selection in the Brew University Book Club. I've got the team ready to rock and roll, so let's get into it. Dustin is here with us. Hi, Dustin. How's it going?
How's it going, Jeff?
I'm good. Glad to have you back with us, as always. Lisa's here, too. Hi, Lisa.
Hey there. How are you?
Good. Coming to us live from the far side of the moon, I see. Chris is here as well, coming to us from the far side of Fort Myers. Hi, Chris. How are you? And Suzanne Borgia is here as well. Hi, Suzanne.
Hey there.
All right. So we are talking about Entree Leadership, the Leadership Treatise by Dave Ramsey. And we are on to chapter 6 called Don't Flop Whoppers, which sounded a little bit to me like a book about the perils of fast food service industry work, but it turns out is instead very much about launching your dreams. So chapter 6, Don't Flop Whoppers and How to Launch Your Dreams with Success. Now, this is another one of those chapters that inherently is sort of aimed at entrepreneurs and those who are up and starting their own small business. And in fact, in this chapter, Dave goes pretty down the rabbit hole of the different types of businesses you might want to start and what their advantages and disadvantages are and things like franchising and MLMs and all this other stuff that definitely does not apply to us. And yet, I think there are still some beautiful pieces we can take away from this because woven into the how-to manual that he writes are the instructions for how to make those things successful no matter what you choose. So I'll open it up as I always do and just ask, what'd you guys think of chapter 6?
I like how he talked about, he said one of the scariest decisions is when to hire your first team member. And I kind of took that, you know, again, we're not opening a business, but I've even thought about just hiring team members in general. I mean, that does get scary. I mean, you don't want to get that decision wrong. You're psychoanalyzing yourself on, I did pick this person, but now did I pick the right person? And the person I didn't pick, was that the right person? And so, I mean, I think just in general, hiring people is definitely a scary decision that you have to make.
Oh, it absolutely is. And there's an entire chapter coming up later about how to make those types of decisions less scary. But to the point here, Chris, and I think you're tapping into something really important. You know, he talks about as a growing business, when is the right time to hire a new person and that's going to add value to the team and not just draw a paycheck and hurt your bottom line. But as leaders in the company, you know, we are ultimately responsible for the teams and the territories that we service. And I think whether we realize it or not, we have a seat at that table and in that decision-making process. Because as leaders, we probably have to be the ones to go forward to our senior leadership and let them know when we think our team is ready to grow. You know, if we sit and wait for what they tell us, oh, you need another sales rep this year. Well, how would they know? They're not the ones down here on the ground. They're not the ones helping us actually do the day-to-day stuff. So it is sort of our job to surface that. Now, ultimately, it may not be our decision like it is for the people he's really targeting here in the book. They may not have that final power of the pen to say yes. But to your point, Chris, even the very act of asking can be a difficult one. How do I know when it's time to ask for more resources? How do I know when it's time to say, we need one more merchandiser, we need one more driver to cover the amount of volume that's coming through? If we're not asking for it, it's not going to happen on its own. And yet, it is a scary decision. So I think there is some value in that mindset of I have to know that when I'm making my pitch, when I'm taking this to my managers and my VPs and my senior VPs and so forth, I've got to know that I'm asking for something I really need and why. And that can be a very daunting ask to say I need more headcount than what I have today.
No, I agree totally. At least in delivery, our the routes on the road, fluctuating market conditions, just where we're at in the market, especially with everything going on right now, to knowing, is this temporary spike in volume? Do we need to add more routes to the road? Do we need to pull routes off the road? That's also a very hard one, too, knowing when to downsize if you need to downsize. Luckily, we haven't had to do that. But yeah, no, I agree. It's very important.
I'm kind of facing that day in and day out because, you know, with all the reroutes that we've had, my little group has, you know, we pack a pretty powerful punch with Florida accounts. We've got about 4,000 of them. And it's just like, and because of, with the COVID-19, a lot of these accounts are closed. So everything has been manageable. But, you know, eventually it's going to open back up. you know. And so, you know, I know that we're making a big push for EO market and, you know, taking so that this way we don't have to actively reach out to these accounts to get the orders on a truck. But it's all human nature. And you know, just because we can reach out to, you know, 50 accounts a day to say, hey, sign up for EO market, only 3 may sign up, you know, and which means that we're still on the hook for 47, you know. So, I mean, it's just, you know, more headcount. That's one of those things where I'm constantly juggling, like, when is the right time to kind of, you know, to recognize that my people are stretched too thin, and, you know, and we need to start putting another person in place, you know.
Yeah, I think this really also speaks to the heart of what he talked about in that idea of an entree leader, that too often, because we work for a company, because we are part of a larger organization, we fall into that role of leader and forget that we have to be a little bit of an entrepreneur ourselves. And it's okay to ask. And maybe we get told no. And maybe now's not the right time. But who else is going to ask on our behalf? It's not going to be the job of the people 3 steps above us to know when the resources are too thin and when things aren't working. They're relying on us. And the great thing about working at the company we do is they're going to listen. They're going to invite and welcome that feedback. They may still say no, but at least you know you're not putting your neck on the line just by asking for resources. And so it's a challenge. It's tough because we want to be good little soldiers, and we want to do the job that we've been given to do, and we want to do it within the constraints we've been given. But the truth of the matter is, as entree leaders, if that's what we're aspiring to become, we have to be the ones sometimes to raise our hand and say, this area is underserved, it's under-resourced, it's under-headcounted. Because if we don't speak up and say that, there's no way that people above us are going to necessarily know that inherently. It's our job to source those issues. So I think it was a great point to bring up early on there. And I think it definitely speaks to, again, if we think of this as running our own little businesses in a way, it makes us more accountable and responsible for all the decisions, even the ones that we don't always think about that we might not have final authority on. We may still need to be the most important part of initiating those conversations and those decisions. Great thought. What else stuck out to you guys about don't flop whoppers and launching your dreams?
He also talked a lot about franchises, and I get to deal with one of our accounts is franchise. And so a lot of these things he talked about, I hear about all the time from the franchisees. You know, they're going back and forth with the franchisor or the main account, I guess you could say. So a lot of this stuff was, you know, it was stuff that I hear all the time about, you know, the failure rate and all the decisions that they make but are forced to make. And, you know, sometimes it sounded great when you first got a franchise, and then now you're 10 years down the road and you're like, why did I do this? You know, so that part, I really enjoyed reading about that because, again, it's something I deal with on the regular. So.
Yeah, I think keeping in mind that this chapter, you know, gives us a perspective on many of our accounts who are the small businesses, and, you know, we have our priorities, but obviously they have their priorities, and kind of thinking back to, you know, what they've put in to make their business the way it is today.
No, you guys are bringing up a great point, right? Which is that, again, maybe this model doesn't fit our business, but it sure fits the businesses of the people we serve. When it comes to our accounts and our retailers, they are franchises. They are small businesses. They're launching their dreams. And a chapter like this gives us insight into how that happens. I think the same would be true on the supplier side. If you think about the small breweries, right? They don't start out coming in always as big swings. Sometimes we've had big swings come in, you know, and big brands that come into the portfolio. But most often these days, the people coming to us looking for support are trying to launch their dream as well. And knowing how that works successfully is a good thing for us because we are their agent in that case, and we want to do it the right way, even if it's not our dream itself. So, you know, they need the right approach, the right amount of time to get started. You know, the biggest flops in craft beer have usually been the biggest launches in my memory. Most recently, I think St. Archer Gold started with a Super Bowl ad and ended with a memo to distributors that it's done, right? And there's a great example of, here's this brand that, you know, big company with big resources all behind it. We're going to launch this thing alongside the Super Bowl. We're going to put all this out there. We're going to have distribution points all over town. We're going to get this thing done. And St. Archer Gold comes to an end with a memo to the distributors that says, yeah, you can pretty much just go ahead and send back whatever's left over and stop worrying about any new stuff, and we won't be supporting this in the market anymore. When he talks about that flopping Whoppers, I know we can all point to brands in our past and even our recent history that have definitely flopped on that. And yet, at the same time, we can also point to brands like Cigar City that starts in a couple of tap rooms. And because it did grow the right way with the right amount of time and with the right care from us into what it now is, which is the number one craft SKU at six pack in the country. So it's definitely, we've seen it in our industry time and time again, the tale of two different brands, that the ones that come in with the big fanfare and the big launch and the big push and end up going nowhere versus the ones that start small, start right, grow the right way, and turn into something special.
It's got to do with the three rings, though. Honestly, it really does. Like, you know, if you've got that center ring of the why you want to do something versus, you know, and then like the how and then the what. You know, I mean, Cigar City, I think, started because he had a passion for like brewing good beer. You know, not that the person that didn't brew up St. Archer's didn't feel the same way, but, you know, it's a different, you know, you grew small and you grew strong. You know, I think he had put something in his book about the mighty oak comes from the smallest acorn, you know, and it's like, and it's the same thing with St. Archer's Gold or with Fortune. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember Fortune. Geez, I remember Aspen Edge and Brutal Fruit. Like, all of these things were big money behind big ideas. And you know, it's like, let's get it everywhere. But if you don't have the heart in the product, then it's going to flop, you know?
Absolutely. And that has to come through them to us, right? It's those big brands that were a corporate idea and a corporate marketing push. There was no passion from them. So there was no passion from us and it flopped. But when a little brewer comes in and tells their story, and that story touches the heart of every rep who then goes out and sells it into accounts by telling and teaching that story, that's how they take foothold and take root and all of a sudden over time are growing into something bigger. I do think it's interesting, you know, he talks about how much passion and calling matters. And we have to be able to translate that on our brewer's behalf, on our supplier's behalf, and same to our customer's behalf. You know, it's, if we go into their account, that account is their passion. It's their calling. What are we going to do to support and understand that? Because if we don't understand it, if we can't join in and be a part of it, we're not going to be serving it in the right way at all.
I always appreciate when we have a supplier come in, you know, it could be a small brand, and they don't come in and say, all right, we need 90% distribution right off the bat. I always appreciate those suppliers who are like, all right, let's pick 10 of the right accounts and let's start there. Or let's stay to this area because this is what we know. And a good one was Fort Myers Brewery. They wanted to stay close to their brewery. They were like, we're not going to go out to Naples. We're going to stay right here in Fort Myers. It's in the name. And now they're a megastar now, you know. So I always appreciate that start small and then grow it the right way.
Was it Dunedin Brewery or Cycle Brewing, one of those that said, we want to be the number one beer in this zip code? In the Dunedin zip code. And they are, I think, by the way, for craft beer. They're like the number, and that was their goal. And then, of course, you know, we're going to come after zip code right next to ours. That's how that's going down. But you're right, Chris. It's that focus, right? Throughout the book so far, he's talked about how much focus is important. And these breweries, we've seen them time and again. And same again with the retail accounts. When they try to be everything, when they try to have every beer in stock, how many small accounts have we watched try to have all the crafts and end up flaming out because they invested too much into too many brands and too many SKUs? And it's like, if you would have just carried the top 10 products that were pull through, you would have had a high profit category that could have then afforded to grow in some other places. But you never established yourself as a destination for beer. You brought in all these craft brands thinking that onesie twosie SKUs were going to do it, and it didn't. They lost focus, thereby losing intensity, thereby not being able to translate into momentum. It happens on both ends. What else did we take away from this chapter, things that are notable about launching dreams?
And even as I touched on earlier with the franchise, it's just the failure rate. He talked about the top five franchise businesses already have almost a 17% failure rate. And that's just the top five. So I can only imagine the bottom of that, of those franchises, they're probably almost all fit. So you just gotta do, it speaks about doing research, talking to people who are already franchisees, because they will, and he's right, because again, I hear this all the time, but they'll give you the true skinny of being a franchisee. They won't, you know, they'll be the great, and then they'll be the ones who absolutely hate it. So if you were gonna get into something, that would be something you have to talk to people who are on the ground floor doing it, who are have been in it for years or have just started, and just kind of get a perspective on all those together.
I think anybody that's going to build out a business for themselves, and I know, you know, JJ Taylor, we're here to support a lot of these places that open up, but it kind of all goes back to what we learned in, what was it, chapter two, about the mission statement. You know, it's like you need to tie it into, like, you know, you can't just open up a franchise just because you're looking to, you know, you want to be the next king of Papa John's. You know, it's like you really, you know, you have to have some love about what you're going to do to actually make an impact in the economy and on your own personal finances. Like, I mean, the only way it grows is if you have that passion, if you like really give it your time. One thing that I read about here a lot, it's about the hard work. It's about, you know, working past 8 hours into the night, you know, and you're not going to have that unless you have a passion and a calling for what you're doing, you know, and all of that kind of goes right back to knowing who you are with the mission statement.
And that's something that I think knowing that as a distributor puts us in a position to help our clientele win by being able to ask the questions that maybe they don't see yet, right? We should challenge our brewery partners and suppliers when they come in. What's the passion here? What's the mission statement? What's your why? If they don't know, how do you expect me to go out and sell it? How do you expect me to go out and sell your beer with passion if you don't come in here with passion? You know, and similarly to our accounts. Why'd you open this up? What's your mission here? What are you trying to accomplish? Who do you want to be? Because if I understand that you're trying to provide the best convenience experience, so passion for you is in quality, and it matters more that we get things right than we worry about other, you know, aspects, I can address that. But if I think it's all about the margin, then I can help you address that too. If they're not thinking about it, we can see and learn from this book that when they're not thinking about it, it's going to harm them. As their distributor partner, sometimes the best thing we can do to serve them is, because we can't answer those questions for them, but if we can ask the questions itself, maybe we push them and nudge them in the right direction towards thinking about things that we know they should be thinking about and probably aren't.
I always wonder when someone opens a new account, why they don't reach out to vendors before they go into this account and buy it. I always wonder that, because you see somebody who's, you know, I had an account that the building's been empty for 10 years. Nicest guy ever, full of passion, and he said, oh, I'm opening this up, what do you guys think? And you know, you don't want to crush the guy's dreams because he already paid for it, but I'm like, it hasn't been open for 10 years. I mean, you know, and I always feel like people do their due diligence before that, and I always think vendors are the best people, who will be very honest with you, you know, and they'll tell you, hey, you know, this hasn't been open for a long time, and when it was open, we were coming here every other week, or when it was open, you know, I was doing 10 cases a week. And, you know, and that goes back to, you said, when you were doing a franchise, get some research, talk to people who are already there, who are already doing it. So
what's the old saying? The guy who makes the most money in the restaurant business is the one that sells the equipment.
Yeah.
Chris, it's so funny that you bring that up. There's a small little, you know, I live in the North Tampa area, and there's like a little area, a small little bodega, like a little Spanish store. That was set up right off of Gun Highway, not too far from where I live. And I could tell you, I mean, I could probably count on one hand how many times people have opened and closed bodegas in that same spot. And so a couple of years ago, I had gotten a word that the account opened back up again. And I was like, you know, he had done this incredibly huge order, like bought like 50 cases of Presidente, 50 cases of Heineken. And, you know, I heard about this because Maria is the one that keyed it in. And I heard about it. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to do my due diligence and make sure I go, you know, I'm a convenience store. I worked convenience stores for 12 years. You know, let me go and meet this guy and talk to him before the driver even gets there, to just kind of see what his thought process is. And to be honest with you, I talked him into like refusing a good portion of that because I knew he was never going to sell that. And, you know, you're talking about people that open up accounts and reaching out to vendors and suppliers and so on and so forth. You know, we're having this conversation and I have the heart to tell them, man, like you're like the fifth or sixth person that's trying to open a Spanish store right here, you know, like good luck at you, you know, but anyway, fast forward, he has, I mean, I'll tell you what, that is that man's passion. Every time I walk in there, you know, he's constantly there. He put so many different elements that the other people that didn't have a passion for it just wanted to open up an account. They didn't put any of the hard work. They didn't put any of the retail or any of the money behind it. The place is gorgeous and constantly their parking lot is full. Now, are they a huge big beer seller? No, they're not. but they're known for, you know, like their Spanish food. They're known for, you know, like their prices. And I mean, it's and I'm just so incredibly proud of him, you know, just because he had the passion, he had the due diligence, he put in the time, the effort, and, you know, and it's doing well, you know, so it's just kind of funny because it's the same location, same concept, you know, and completely different results.
Boy, what a great story. And I think that really speaks to sort of the last bit of what I took out of this chapter, which is that passion trumps the obstacles. You know, and he talks about the reason you have to have passion to get into doing a business for yourself is because that is what's going to run you through the obstacles that are there. I don't think he says it in the book, but another favorite Ramsey quote is he says, if my team's going to hit walls, they better hit them at full force. There better be a little team member shaped hole in the wall where they hit it, because their best chance for knocking down that wall is to hit it as fast and as hard as possible. And I don't want them to hit those walls. I don't want them to bump in that wall. I want them to crash into that wall. Because that's what passion does, is it knocks down barriers that might otherwise not be able to be knocked down. And so I do think it is such an important part. And Lisa, your story really speaks to exactly that, that it, you know, it wasn't that the idea was wrong. It wasn't that the concept couldn't work. It's that nobody had really had the passion to overcome the obstacles, make the sacrifices, and make it work. And knowing which suppliers and which retailers we're dealing with that have that versus the ones who don't is really important to us, because it helps us know where to put our time and effort. We want to work with the best. We want to put our time in with the best. And if we know they've got that, I'm going to be willing to do a lot more for them than if I know they're just there trying to cut costs, trying to cut corners, trying to collect a paycheck and move on, and probably not going to be around as long. Makes us a little less interested sometimes in wanting to put a lot of investment in when we know they're not investing themselves. Well, I think the key here is, again, to remember that even in the chapters that aren't directly applicable to what we do, there are things about it that apply, if not to us, then certainly to the businesses we serve. And as a distributor who's there to make small suppliers and small retailers successful, understanding them better, knowing what they're up against, having some insight into their mindset, and being able to challenge them into the right places by knowing the questions to ask and knowing the things that should matter is another way that we can be first choice for them and what can differentiate us from their competition, because we can help them in ways that they may not even realize they need the help. So I love that we were able to take some stuff out of a chapter that isn't directly related to us. That's good work today, team. I appreciate all the effort. All right, so with that, we bring another chapter of the Entree Leadership Book Club to a close. I want to thank all my guests one last time for joining us today. Suzanne, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Dustin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
Pleasure. Chris, glad to have you with us.
Thanks, Jeff.
And Lisa, thank you as always. And thank all of you who are listening to us as well. We'll have another chapter, another episode coming for you again next week as we continue our walk through Entree Leadership by Dave Ramsey here on the Brew University Book Club Podcast, Season 1. See you next time.
Thank you.